As with many Jews of a certain generation, my father is an expert on who's Jewish. You can sit with him and watch a baseball game and say, wow, he made a great catch. And my father will go, you know, his grandfather's uncle had a sister whose husband was Jewish. Not only that, but so's the owner of the team that he plays for. And we all play this game to some extent. When someone does something wonderful in the world, we try to see, you know, there's a Jew somewhere in their ancestry, and we can usually either find one or assume one. But the opposite is also true. Not only do we search for ancestry, Jewish ancestry, in people who do well, but we also try to embrace those who do well who are not Jewish. Kol tzadikei umot ha'olam yesh lahem chelek ba'olam haba, our tradition says, and it says it more than once, all the righteous of all the nations have a place in the world to come. The world to come is not a preserve for Jews. It's a place for anybody who is good. And if you want a beautiful and poignant illustration of this philosophy, that Judaism embraces goodness wherever it finds it, you can't do better than look at this, the title of this morning's parsha. This is, after all, arguably the most important section of the Torah. It's the revelation at Sinai. It's the Ten Commandments. And it's called Yitro, Jethro. And Jethro wasn't Jewish. And that is a statement. Because not only is the Parsha called Yitro, but at the beginning of the Parsha, Yitro goes to Moses, presumably the wisest, the best, the most knowledgeable, the holiest person who ever lives, and tells him how to run his business. He says, you have to get yourself some help. You can't do this by yourself. And Moses listens to him and learns from him. Those Jews who are unwilling to learn from the wisdom of the non-Jewish world are being un-Jewish. And so this morning, I want to celebrate two great non-Jews from whom we have a lot to learn. I'm celebrating them because this past Thursday, it was each of their 200th birthday. And that is Charles Darwin and Abraham Lincoln. Both of them born the same day, 200 years ago, and both of them profoundly influential in the shaping of this world, our modern world, and of course, this nation, the United States of America. And what I want to do is not review the teachings of their lives or speak about them biographically, but highlight three religious messages that emerge from their work. And by the way, just so you should know, what I'm doing, at least part of it, about Darwin is being done by hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of synagogues and churches throughout the nation. All these preachers and rabbis and ministers and priests have declared this Evolution Shabbat, in which they speak about the religious significance of Darwin's insights into the world. So let me give you, I don't know what the others will talk about, but let me give you three messages that arise from the discoveries of evolutionary science that have a great deal to do with our religious outlook. The first, and in some ways the most important, is the quest for truth in and of itself. Chotamo shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu emet. The seal of God is truth, we are told. And that which is true, Maimonides tells us, can't possibly contradict the Torah. In fact, Maimonides says, if something is proved to me true and it seems to contradict the Torah, it just tells me that I have misinterpreted the Torah. And so that search for truth is at the heart of our tradition. Because otherwise, you're saying that really we don't care what's true, we just do what we want. And that seems to me an insult to God who created the world and the human mind. And I think that's one of the reasons why so many Jews have been involved in the sciences, in all the sciences, because this drive to find out the way God's world works is a religious impulse, not just an intellectual impulse. In fact, Maurice Samuel, the author and lecturer, he's the one who introduced Yiddish literature to the English-speaking world. He had a theory about why the Jews have survived for thousands of years. He said, the Jewish people is a people that is not going to die until they figured it out. He says, we're just not happy until we have the answer. And since we don't have the answer yet, we're sticking around because we've got to figure it out. He also, by the way, as long as I'm on Maurice Samuel, he also had a theory for why people don't like the Jews. He had a wonderful one-sentence answer. He said, no one loves his alarm clock. And the Jews were put into this world to wake the world up, and nobody likes their alarm clock. It's a beautiful way of conceiving of it. But anyway, so the first message is the quest for truth that Darwin has given us. The second is embodied very beautifully in an interpretation that the writer of the Torah Tamima, Rabbi Baruch Epstein, gives to the name El Shaddai. El Shaddai, you know, is one of God's names. And Rabbi Epstein writes, says, what it means is, I am the God who says die, who says enough. I'm only creating the world up to this point. The rest is for you to create. In other words, the world is in a continuous process of creation. It's not done. And that is, of course, the message of evolution. You might think that the world is static. It's created this way, it stops this way, it never changes, but along comes science and says, you're wrong, the world is a flowing river. It's always being newly created. Some things are dying off and some things are being born. God created a world in which there is infinite possibility of newness, of creation. And that's a much more beautiful picture of the world. Who wants to watch a still photograph if you can see a movie? Right? Who wants things to stay in only one way when you have the possibility of the flow of life? And that is the third religious lesson that I want to draw from evolution, that we are all tied together in one vast web of life. We know that because, after all, we know from science that the same molecules that form the highest form of life are present in some way in the lowest form of life, that everything participates in the same nature. And you would expect that if everything is created by the same God. God creates everything, so everything shares in this web of life. And that idea that everything is part of the same web of life and everything is in a continual process of creation allows us to understand why evolution not only is compatible with faith, but in some ways is a more beautiful and enhancing and embracing picture of faith. It's not that one day God went like this and the world was created and stayed the way it was so that the way we are now is the way we were a million years ago, a billion years ago. No, quite the opposite. As actually, to give you a nice analogy, as Kenneth Miller, who is a professor of biology and evolution at Brown University and also a believing Catholic, puts it in his book about God and Darwin, he says, which is more impressive? Is it more impressive that somebody sinks a single ball on the pool table, or that he sets it up so that one ball hits another, hits another, hits another, hits another, hits another, and the last one goes into the pocket? He says that's how God creates the world, through a chain of events that create beautiful things and throw off all sorts of wonders that we never would have anticipated, and even wonders that have not yet come to be. So we can take, as we did from Jethro, beautiful religious instruction from Darwin, as we can, of course, from Lincoln. And what do we learn from Lincoln? First of all, and this is something that the Jewish tradition is built on, Lincoln teaches us the power of words, the enormous, immense, unfathomable power of words. You know, in Judaism, we know this because, after all, whatever synagogue you walk into anywhere in the world, one thing you can be sure of, the focus of that synagogue will be a book. Somehow the architecture of the synagogue will be such that your eye will be focused on words. We don't put a person as the focus of a synagogue, we put a book as the focus. And that's because we know that when God wishes to create the world, God does it with words. Baruch she'amar v'haya ha'olam. Blessed be God who spoke, and there was a world. In the midst of the Civil War, Lincoln gets up at Gettysburg, and he speaks 10 sentences. The Gettysburg Address is fewer than 300 words. It's a lot shorter than this sermon has already been. And he says in the Gettysburg Address, the world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it will never forget what they did here. And yet, remarkably, what we remember is what he said there. His words are imperishable, and they'll be remembered long after the names of the people who fought at Gettysburg are forgotten. Words immortalize their actions. And that's a powerful religious lesson that the Jewish tradition knows, but that, of course, is always important to relearn. Second is, of course, something that is at the heart of our tradition and that is the great theme of Lincoln's legacy, which is that only in freedom can people create, can people realize the potential of their souls, and even can people worship the way they need to worship. That's what the rabbis tell us is the lesson of the Torah being given at Sinai. They say the Torah couldn't have been given in Egypt because slaves are not free to accept God's word. Only free people can accept God's word or reject God's word. That's what it means to be free. And were it not for Lincoln, I suppose eventually freedom would have come to this country, but surely not as quickly and surely not as well. And that is, of course, Lincoln's greatest legacy, is not just preserving the Union, but preserving the Union with an insistence on the delivery of the Emancipation Proclamation that proclaimed freedom for a land that had long used the words of freedom, but had not realized freedom in people's lives. And then finally, Lincoln was a religious man, but of an unconventional sort. Very hard to pin down what Lincoln's religious convictions were. But one thing that we do know was he was a believer with humility. He spoke about the North and the South. Now imagine this for a moment. He's the leader in a civil war. The civil war he believes with all his heart is important to fight and that he's right. And yet he knows, and he says to his cabinet, that both the North and South use the same Bible and pray to the same God. And therefore, he said, the prayers of both could not be answered. The prayers of neither have been answered fully. The Almighty has his own purposes. That's religious humility. Again and again in our world, we hear leaders of democracies as well as of tyrannies express how sure they are that their purposes and God's purposes are identical. Lincoln was more humble than that. When he was told by a northern minister that he hoped God, the Lord, was on their side, this is what Lincoln said. I'm not at all concerned about that, but it is my constant prayer and anxiety that I and this nation should be on the Lord's side. Not that God should be on our side, but that we should be on God's side. That sense of religious humility is also an important and a painful lesson for people to learn. I cannot tell you how often in our own community, as well as among leadership, there are people who speak as though they are certain that basically God's on our side. It's never so simple. God creates the whole world and everything in it, right? That's one of the lessons we just learned from Darwin. And choosing sides is never as easy for God as it is for us. Those three lessons of freedom, of the power of words, and of religious humility come to us from Lincoln. On this Shabbat, we celebrate the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments reveal to us two things about ourselves, one taught by Darwin and one taught by Lincoln. Darwin taught us that we're animals. We are. We share the nature of animals. We share much of the genetic material of animals. And our drives are animalistic. That's why we need the Ten Commandments. If we weren't animals, we wouldn't need all those admonitions that are carved up there. Don't do this, don't do that. You'd say, of course, why would I ever do that? The answer is because you're an animal. Right? The same thing that my mother used to say to me when I ate improperly. Why are you eating like an animal? Had I been smarter, I would have said, because I'm an animal. Actually, I wouldn't have. But you don't give the Ten Commandments to animals. If we were only animals, then we wouldn't have the Ten Commandments. We need them because we are animals. We get them because we have something more than animals in us, which is where we turn to Lincoln, who in his first inaugural address appealed to the nation for the better angels of our nature. We are animals and we are angels. We're both, all wrapped up in human beings. Animals, so we need the Ten Commandments. Angels, and that's why we get them. There is a blessing that you are supposed to say when you see somebody who is filled with worldly learning. There's a blessing that you say when you see a sage of the Torah, but there's also a blessing that you see when you meet someone who's filled with the learning of the world. It is Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech haOlam Shenatan miChochmato leBasar vaAdam, which is, blessed are you, O Lord our God, who has given of his wisdom to flesh and blood. I think on this Shabbat there is no more appropriate blessing. When we remember the legacy of these two extraordinary individuals, both humble, both kind, both loved by the people around them, and both great in their courage and in their learning and in their legacy. Baruch atah Adonai, blessed are you, O God, Shanatan michochmato lebasar vadam, who has given people, Jewish, non-Jewish, all over the world, something of your wisdom and allowed us to learn from them. Shabbat shalom. Shabbat shalom.